Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. California's northern Pacific coast was once covered with towering old redwoods. 95% of that ancient forest was leveled in decades of clear-cutting. Explorer conservationist Mike Fay walked 1,800 miles of redwood country from Big Sur to Oregon to get up close to the great tree's range today. He sees loggers and environmentalists coming to some new understandings and new hope for the trees. This hour on Point, we are plunging into America's redwood forest and its future. Joining me now from Ketchikan, Alaska is Mike Fay. He's a National Geographic explorer in residence and a conservationist with the Wildlife Conservation Society. After 3 decades of work in Central Africa, he's turned his attention to California's redwoods. In 2007, he set out on an 11-month, 1,800-mile trek south to north through redwood country from Big Sur to Oregon. He's featured in the National Geographic cover story this month. Mike Fay, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Wilmington, North Carolina, is Joel Bourne. He wrote the National Geographic cover story, Redwoods, the Super Trees. Joel Bourne, it's great to have you here as well. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tom.
So, Mike, first of all, the picture's right here in front of me, and I have to ask you, I mean, you're walking through these unbelievable stands of trees and jumbled, tumbled, giant stumps and logs and everything else, and you wear sandals on an 1,800-mile trek? Sandals?
Well, think about the opposite. If you wore boots and you had socks and you're on the trail for 333 days and your feet are wet and you've got sand inside those boots, your feet would be in a hamburger in a week's time. So, you know, with sandals, your feet get beat up a lot, and certainly in the redwoods, they got cold, if not frozen, many times. But all in all, it's the only way to go for me.
Mike, describe for us, if you would. I mean, we know a lot of this forest got cut down, and you describe that portion of what was old-growth forest. But when you were in the thickest and the densest of the redwood forest now, where it was just as dense as it got on your trek, on your journey, what did it look like? Put us there.
Well, if you can imagine, you know, walls of fallen trees surrounding you everywhere, you can't move. You have to climb. It's like bouldering, except you're going over these enormous trunks, and sometimes those trunks are 3 or 4 deep. You can't see the bottom. Sometimes you can fall maybe 30 or 40 feet down into, you know, this jumble of logs. It's covered with huckleberry and sword ferns and all kinds of vegetation. And then you have hundreds of these gigantic towering trees surrounding you, you know. So it's by far and away the most magnificent forest on the planet. There's no doubt about that.
And when you are in the terrain of the clear cut that used to be, that was old growth, ancient redwood forest, but no longer, what's that look like, where it's really scraped away?
Well, what always amazes me about cut-over forest is it's very difficult to even imagine what was there. You know, there's a lot of bare ground. There's hardly any wood on the ground. There's a lot of burned stumps and slash. It's a very hot and dry world out there, and so it's like night and day. It's a completely different place.
Joel Bourne, Mike Fay made the trek on foot. You've researched the history. Remind us of what once stood on the California coast or within miles of it, and what took it away?
Well, this is, you know, the redwoods have been a source of wood products since the 1850s, since California became a state, and really built San Francisco after the fire. There was a tremendous push to harvest these trees. Earthquake and fire, 1906, mm-hmm. You know, took out a huge swath of the city that was rebuilt largely with redwoods. And then when they moved the industrial sort of mechanism into the forest with sort of steam power, steam donkeys and things, it made it much more easier for them to get at these incredibly large, incredibly tremendous trees. There was also a great sort of collection of industrial ownership that came in about that time when you know, sort of part of the Homestead Act. These huge investors came in and bought up lands at $250 an acre, using hook or by crook, you know, some homesteaders that they would pay to put their 160 acres out and then purchase it from them after they'd spent their 2 years. So ultimately, the vast swath of the redwoods was collected by and purchased by these very large timber organizations, which exploited them to the hilt, especially after World War II, when suddenly you had this huge housing boom in Southern California. And then you had, you know, suddenly no longer steam, but diesel Caterpillar tractors, diesel trucks, log trucks, chainsaws, everything just going crazy. And that's when they started really ramping up the harvest that left so much great destruction.
Of course, they've been iconic in this country for a long, long time. People have known it. But even so, they came down even when they were iconic. Here's a clip from a 1940 short documentary called Redwood Saga, chronicling Northern California's lumber industry.
The redwoods that grow along the coast live to be 2,000 years old. They are young at 350 years, they are mature at 1,000 years, and they reach old age at 1,500 years. All of the world's history since Christ was born could have occurred during the life of perhaps one of these redwoods.
A little 1940 view of the redwood forest. Mike Fay just walked 1,800 miles down or up that forest, Big Sur to Oregon. And Mike, I mean, we've known this was kind of the forest of the gods for a long time, and yet so much of it came down. Did you have the sense in, this was in 2007 you set out, did you have the sense of walking through, you know, a battered remains, or what did it feel like coming up through redwood country, Mike?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, 95% of this forest was cut down, and so 95% of your walk is through second growth forest, if not third growth forest. And what one, you know, fact is that most of the second growth has already been cut as well. So finding 100-year-old second growth stands is very rare. So, you know, if you can imagine every day for all these months, you're walking through gulch after gulch after gulch after gulch, hundreds and hundreds of little drainages. And what's really amazing about redwoods is all the stumps are still there. So you can see what was and what is today. And just to see how thorough this process was, when you think, God, there isn't, we haven't seen a single old growth tree in 3 weeks or 3.5 weeks, you know, and you just think, man, these guys were unbelievably thorough. They didn't miss a single tree. It's really phenomenal.
Describe for us, if you would, Mike, the difference between walking through old growth redwood forest and walking through, you know, second growth or third growth, if it's there. Just the feel, the look, the scale.
Well, you know, the old growth is like walking through a city with 100-story buildings everywhere. And all of that diversity that you can pack into a city like that, you know, you think about going up every single building and into every little office and every little store and subterranean cavities in a city like that compared to a parking lot. You know, it's basically that kind of difference where this forest, when it's old and big, it's vast. It's endless because it's so complex and so tall and so just, you know, cavernous. And when it's cut down, it just becomes much flatter and much more monotypic. And the other thing that has happened in those places is the amount of soil that was moved in those forests has made it so that you've got just a huge amount of erosion and gullying and
by bulldozers and everything else when it was at
so
its peak.
It's you know, it's just a completely different world.
But you're making the point now, and we'll talk about the 90s and 80s and into the 90s when there was so much clash over timbering there, logging. But you're talking now about a kind of consensus maybe emerging on some sustainable harvesting in the redwood forests. Are you confident in that, Mike?
Well, I would say that this is the 21st century. And when you look at every human population on the planet, people are starting to recognize that ecosystems and ecosystem services and having a functioning planet are important. You know, we've never really valued those things before in the history of humanity, because we've always been faced by abundance and a frontier. Well, those things are starting to change, and in California, where, you know, 95% of this forest was cut down, what we're seeing is, for the first time in the last century and a half, the forest inventory is starting to grow back. You know, you're actually accumulating wood in the redwood forest instead of liquidating that forest.
And now you're talking about single tree selection as an option to clear cutting. Are environmentalists on board with that, going in and cutting single trees out?
Well, you'd be amazed. I've been talking to tree sitters and relatively radical environmental groups all the way up to industrial logging companies, and there are many, many people from completely different walks of life that are starting to converge on this idea that single tree selection and growing bigger and better trees, more biomass on the ground and better quality wood products is something we all think is a way forward.
We're going to look at that. We're talking today about America's redwood forests. Mike Fay has walked 1,800 miles, the length of old redwood country, for National Geographic. Joel Byrne, National Geographic, his writer is with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from redwood forests to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Did you know this country has sawed down 95% of its redwood old-growth forests? Can we harvest and have our redwoods long-term? In the summer of 1990, people were very upset. This is really recent stuff. Protesters on the California-Oregon border demonstrating here in this tape against the cutting of redwoods, sitting down in front of logging trucks and jumping up on a load of the trees. You may remember people sleeping in the trees, chaining themselves to trees. That's when the logging companies and environmentalists were really in a tough, tough standoff. People were hurt badly. People died. Joel Byrne, take us back to the 90s, the 80s and 90s, and what had environmentalists so up in arms at that time in the long train of logging history here about what was going on in redwood country, Joel?
Well, this was something that had sort of started in the 1980s when, you know, the number of old-growth groves started falling fairly quickly. During about the mid-80s, this is when Charles Hurwitz with Maxim Corporation, a Houston-based financier, bought out the Old Pacific Lumber Company, which had been operating up in that part of the world fairly conservatively for, you know, almost 100 years. And suddenly he had, in one fell swoop, with a hostile takeover, 70% of all the remaining old-growth groves on private property.
The takeover underwritten, and you remind us, with junk bonds provided by the financier, Michael Milken.
Michael Milken, that's
and,
right.
And he made no apologies. He was going to go in there and saw it down.
Absolutely. I mean, he was basically taking the Wall Street capitalist mindset and moving it toward, or focusing it like an arrow on this incredible forest resource. And so he went from sort of a sort of selection model harvest that the Murphy family, which had run the company for many, many generations, had used, and decided to become a clear cutter, and immediately started doubling, even tripling, the amount of wood that was coming out of this forest. And the protest really came to a head over the Headwaters Forest, which was the largest intact block in private hands at the time, and which Hurwitz was dead set on cutting, and which really got the environmentalists up in that area just apoplectic.
Now,
and so again, and so that was one of the big flashpoints for a lot of the conflict.
Now, you've got some new ownership here, which may bring a new attitude. May not. I mean, nobody owns the whole thing. But a big chunk now is in the hands of, you write, the Mendocino Redwood Company. This is now owned by the Fisher family of San Francisco, who made their fortune with Gap and the Banana Republic clothing store chains. Do they have a different attitude?
That's right. The Mendocino Redwood Company came in sort of the late 90s and bought up land after the Louisiana Pacific decided to move elsewhere. And it really instigated this sort of idea that, you know, let's go back and do some restoration forestry. These were lands that had been heavily logged by the large corporate Louisiana Pacific. And so they started rebuilding roads. They started doing a lot of interesting forestry as well as sort of the selection forestry. Mike knows about it very well. in which they're trying to really increase the growth on the forest without doing clear cuts. And so they have a range of things that they're doing in terms of selection forestry that they feel are going to help benefit them in the long run, but, you know, basically foregoing short-term profits to increase their investment and the production of the woods. And since then, of course, they made a bid for Pacific Lumber Company and purchased it actually right when Mike was walking through the woods. So it was an incredible time, incredible changeover in sort of philosophies for a very large chunk of industrial timberlands in the Redwoods.
We're going to look at this selection forestry approach. We're getting a lot of response here online on our Facebook page at On Point Radio. Rachel talking about growing up in the Bay Area, spending, you know, mind-blowing time in these forests. The closest sensation was standing in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, she writes. And here's Judy, who grew up in Northern California, walking in those redwood forests, lives in Chicago now, and she says they use redwood mulch in the spring plantings. The scent alone chokes me up. Jesse's calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. Jesse, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi there. Actually, Dr. Lewis, MD, PhD in biology.
Nice to have you.
I grew up in California in the World War II baby boom, and I spent a great deal of time out in the redwoods. I was, as a biologist, collecting the various salamanders and observing the trees, feeling awe and wonder, incredible awe and wonder. It was almost like, well, it really was kind of a religious experience, connecting me with something much greater to myself. Then as time went on, Mr. Hurwitz, who I'm sure that you all are quite, I mean, the National Geographic is very careful to not slander, and his folks went ahead and just cut in there. I'd like to know your guest's opinion of that, and I'd like to acknowledge that people who grew up there felt a sense of violation or invasion, much as someone who's been molested does, when they saw these gorgeous, ancient, irreplaceable giants leaving the area.
Yes, indeed. Joel, that's exactly what you're writing about. This was Charles Hurwitz, CEO of Maxim out of Houston, who came in.
That's right. And the most, you know, one of the interesting things is, you know, originally I think the loggers were sort of, hey, this is great. We're going to make a lot more wood. We're going to make a lot more money. We put on, more shifts. But toward the end, when they actually started seeing, especially the old guys, started seeing what Hurwitz, the cutting program was coming on, I think in the end, they started feeling violated as well. And that, you know, suddenly they realized, hey, this isn't sustainable and we're cutting ourselves out of jobs here. And which, you know, is why I think there's a new movement afoot to sort of make this harvest plan a little more sustainable.
Mike, what does sustainable forestry actually look like? I'm trying to remember here. They want to cut something like, a 10% at a time or a third at a time? Or describe it for us, selection forestry.
Well, it's quite variable, I would say. It's dependent on every landowner and every forester's kind of techniques and objectives. And so, you know, you get guys that are good at it and other guys that are kind of experimenting with it. But in general, you know, if you kind of walk the range and you talk to all these guys that are doing this, what you have to remember is sustainable in this case is not good enough when you're first starting out because you have to rebuild the forest inventory. A lot of these forests have been so hammered that they've gone from, you know, say 100,000 board feet per acre down to 15 or 20,000 board feet, and in some cases 5 or 6 on the redwoods and other commercial species. So we're starting at a very low level. You have to rebuild the forest, and not only that, you have to rebuild the entire infrastructure that was either abandoned or semi-abandoned by previous owners. And so there's this gigantic backlog of restoration work that needs to be done, which is extremely expensive. And so this is a huge process we're talking about. We're not just talking about, you know, selection forestry, but part of that is this notion that redwoods, when you cut them, they sprout. And so for every old-growth tree that was out there, there's maybe now 10 trees, right, 15 trees.
Okay.
And so if you have those 15 trees and you go in 45 years after they've been cut and you say, let's take out the guys that are kind of, you know, the guys that don't have the greatest potential for growth, rather than the opposite, which is typical of a lot of what they would call high-grading operations, they'll go in and take the best trees and leave the worst. Well, you know, that doesn't work because you end up with all these runts out there. But if you start really getting good at looking at, okay, this tree is really going to pop when I take this tree out, and this tree is wind firm, so it's not going to blow over when I take out this tree. And I take out one-third of those trees every 15, 20 years. What we see is the release that occurs is very large. These trees grow bigger and better faster, and you have a forest the whole time. And so you think, man, that's an amazing thing. That's something that is very innovative. It doesn't cut you off in the short term because you're if you go to 3 acres instead of 1 acre clear cut and you're taking out one third of the 18 inch and above trees, you're getting good volume out immediately, but you're sending this forest on a completely different trajectory. And at the same time, you're rebuilding roads, you're changing out culverts, you're taking out some of the hardwoods that are overabundant. You're really sending this forest on a completely different trajectory rather than just clear cutting and sending it back to square one.
But Mike, in that scenario, may I ask, do any of the trees remain to go up to their sort of old growth size? Do any get to live on to 200, 500, 1,000, 2,000 years or not?
That would depend completely on the owner. And so there are many people in the range who are saying, oh, I'm going to keep 5 trees per acre here because my objective is to have, you know, a forest that has big trees. Others are saying, okay, I'm going to thin 2 or 3, 4 times, and I'm going to just let it go, and I'm going to have an old-growth forest. Others say, you know, I want to harvest more aggressively, so I'll hover around, you know, kind of the 30, 40-inch range, and I'll just keep harvesting continuously, and I'm not going to really select trees that will get bigger. So it's quite variable. There are hundreds of landowners, and everyone has their objectives. For the industrial guys that are doing it, like MRC, HRC, you know, their objective is to continually harvest trees. So the leave trees there would be wildlife trees and riparian trees. And so even in these industrial models, you're seeing a lot of trees that are going to become old growth over time.
Let me bring another voice in here just for some perspective on what you're describing. Scott Greason joins us from Arcata, California. He's executive director of the Environmental Protection Information Center, nonprofit activist group, been very vocal about protecting redwoods since the 1980s. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for covering this.
It's a pleasure, but a lot of people are very invested in this, and I can imagine them listening and trying to figure out who knows what angle they'll come at it from. Maybe from a lumbering angle, maybe from a real environmentalist angle, closer to yours. From that angle, is this good? Is it good to be in there cutting a third of the trees every 10 or 15 years? Is that what people fought for in the 80s and 90s? Is it healthy?
Well, I think you got to go back to that the basic premise, the ground we start with, which is that we've lost 95% of the original forests.
Mm-hmm.
And as Mike was describing from his trip, you know, through these wasted lands, we have wrecked an enormous amount of territory. And redwoods have this incredible capacity to regrow, but that doesn't immediately lead to a healthy forest, to a functional forest ecosystem. So, yeah, I think a big part of what people were fighting for and are still working for out here on what we call the leading edge of the continent on the North Coast is restoration. And what Mike is seeing is the fruits of sort of the first generation of people who've really made it work. I think what we're seeing now is the end of the old-growth liquidation era, but really the beginning of an era where we have to choose a path. Are we going to do, you know, more short-term forestry? Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Or are we going to, you know, set ourselves on a path for long-term restoration and rebuilding?
Scott, do you see selective cutting as compatible with restoration?
I think I do. I think selection forestry is a critical element of restoration in redwood forests and probably in many other forests as well. You know, one part of this is we've got to do a more careful kind of forestry. Another part is that we've got to have much longer rotation ages. And we were just talking a little bit ago about the transition from the old Pacific Lumber's liquidation practices under Charles Hurwitz to the new Humboldt Redwood Company's restoration-oriented forestry. That's a big piece of it. There's another piece that really needs to come into place, and that's the significant chunk of the redwood forest that remains in the hands of the Green Diamond Redwood Company. Green Diamond is still committed to 50-year rotations, to a set of practices that have 80% of their logging being done by clear-cut methods. That's not sustainable. So by contrast to that set of practices, I say yes, the kind of selection forestry Mike's pointing to is much more sustainable. But, you know, a lot of what we got to do now is find a way to get on that long-term course and then try to, you know, build a society that can protect forests in the long run. You know, we're not going to be here in 200 years to make those choices.
But we hope that a lot of these trees might be. Scott, stand
exactly.
by. Curtis in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Curtis, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I guess I'm kind of wondering, the 5% of the trees that are left, are we talking about protecting them? I have just two parts, and I'll make them brief. Because if we're not talking about protecting the 5% that are left, then what is sustainable? A sustainable forest in that regard? In other words, a tree that takes 2,000 years to become an old growth or considered old growth or somewhere is in that neighborhood, 1,000 years. That's a long time away from now. So if we take these remaining 5%, in other words, the old growth forest will be all gone. Sure, there'll still be redwoods, but the old growth forest will be gone.
What about the idea of cutting redwoods at all, Curtis?
I don't think that it's necessary. And I'll just briefly tell you, my background is I'm a timber framer and an antique home restoration. I do antique home restorations, but for the last 10 years or so, I've been building furniture. And from my perspective of been working with wood for over 20 years, there's a lot of other sustainable forests out there, oak, maple, you know, there are a number of sustainable forests out there and wood grown in sustainable forests that we can do everything we need to do with.
So
redwood's not a great furniture, great wood for furniture building. It's not really, it's a beautiful wood.
Why use it at all? We've got options. We're up against the clock here. Scott Greeson, in a word, is that an option? I mean, why cut it at all? Our woodworker friend in Virginia asks.
Well, honestly, I think for that wrecked 95%, we need to do some cleaning up. We've made a big mess, and the fact that a kind of forestry that produces very high-quality wood, that rot-resistant redwood, is not only compatible with protecting clean water and wildlife habitat, but actually grows the bigger trees that are going to sequester more carbon than any other forest, any other biosystem on the planet, says to me that not only do we have a right to do some judicious logging, we may actually have an obligation to do that.
Scott Greeson with the Environmental Protection Information Center in Arcata, California. Scott, we're very grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for your time.
Here's how the country looked at redwoods for a long time. Cutting, 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 but there was a don't worry message as well back in 1940. Here it is.
Down they come, some of the world's oldest, biggest, and tallest trees. Trees that grow over 350 feet high. Trees that may be over 20 feet thick at the base. Trees that are so big that more than 20 houses can be made from just one tree. But don't think these giants are being completely destroyed. Many of the oldest and the biggest of the redwoods are being saved. Parks with thousands of acres of redwoods are set aside for our enjoyment.
Yes, indeed they were, but an awful lot went for those 20 houses at a time, appetites of American home builders and others. Let's hear from Jim in Evansville, Indiana. Jim, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Two-part question. How much of the ancient redwoods are currently protected by the national parks system? And two, are people still currently cutting down the 1,000 and 1,500-year-old trees that your guest spoke about?
Good questions, both. Michael, I'll come first to you. That 5% of old growth that wasn't cut down when the 95% was, how much of that is in national parks, Mike?
Well, there's national, and then there's state parks, and there's county parks, and there's city parks. So it's a lot of different kinds of public space out there. What happened was back in the early 1900s, people started to recognize, hey, these timber barons, they're going to cut down every single one of these trees. So we got to start protecting them. And, you know, these protests didn't start in the 1980s. They started way back in early 1900s. And in 1916, around there, people were down in Pacific Lumber Company land sitting in front of trucks. And that's why we have Bull Creek Flats, Humboldt Redwood State Park right now. So when you look at the old growth, most of what is out there left is already in a park of some kind.
Like 90% in a park, almost all of it in a park? Is anybody cutting down 1,000-year-old trees?
I'd say well over 90% of old growth is in the parks. There's a smattering of old growth across private lands, you know, 1 acre here, 2 acres there, 10 acres here. A lot of those lands are now being looked at as marbled murrelet habitat or wildlife habitat, and the Department of Fish and Game and Water Quality and other controlling agencies are preventing people from cutting those trees to a large extent. That doesn't mean there isn't still old growth being cut down on private land. There most definitely is. But, you know, the rate at which even those last 5% are being cut compared to 2 or 3 decades ago is vastly diminished. And so, you know, if you look at MRC, HRC, who now own 1/4 of the entire Redwood Range, they have a company policy that says, we will not cut any old growth trees, period. If you can identify an old growth tree on our land, we will not cut it. And so, you know, those policies are changing in the industrial companies as well.
We'll hear more on that policy. Let's get a call from Jeff in Morrisville, Vermont. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hey there. How are you today?
Pretty well. What do you think, Jeff? What are you hearing?
Well, as a former environmental activist, forestry, specific in the Northeast, you know, for 5 years, I think it's great that we're having this conversation. A lot of what I've heard has sort of answered some of my questions. The big concern I have is this framing of, you know, ancient forests, old growth forests as industrial landscapes. I think we have so little left of this across the country, whether it's redwood forest or the old growth white pine forest of the Northeast, that fundamentally intact ecosystems should just be left alone as a reservoir of genetic material. And if we need to do restoration forestry on the landscapes that we've already devastated, then that's where we're going to have to play.
Jeff, I've got that perspective, and I appreciate it. We're going to turn to another silviculturist in just a moment, and I'll go there. But Joel Bourne, if I may, first to you, just to Mike Fay's point, that the protests for saving these forests have gone on for a long time. I'm reading all the way back in 1917. National Geographic sent an its editor out with a bunch of conservationists. 1917 took a trip that showed how much destruction of redwoods had occurred with the construction of Highway 101, which I drove just a year or two ago. Beautiful coming down that coast, but that in itself made a lot of destruction here. Give us some of the sense of how the 5% of trees that were saved and ended up in national parks, let's say, which a lot of people are thinking about with Ken Burns' show recently. How did that happen? Who pushed for that, Joel?
Sure. Well, as Mike mentioned, there was an enormous amount of concern when in the early 1900s, when California saw these massive trees coming down, and virtually, you know, without any restrictions on the logging. And so the first, you know, the Save the Redwoods League was established with the help of one of the early editors of National Geographic, who published several articles on the redwoods. And suddenly, private individuals started purchasing groves. And those groves, thankfully, through the Save the Redwoods League, ended up becoming the backbone of the state parks. And so what you really saw was, along with the rise in industrial forestry, you saw a rise in sort of the incredibly powerful environmental movements that were coming up about the same time. Now, one of the points I'd like to bring to one of your earlier callers about why don't we just lock it up? Well, as Mike saw in many parts of California, if the redwoods have no value, if they don't get bought for parks, then suddenly you start seeing development encroaching on lands. You suddenly start seeing vineyards going up in Sonoma County that are taking out redwood, you know, what have been industrial timberlands, and taking it out of redwood production altogether. So unless you have some sort of logging practice, or you know, that allows redwood to be profitable on a timber scale, that funds, you know, jobs for timber workers in some of these very remote rural communities, then you're going to lose redwood lands altogether. Well, the potential is there to start seeing it whittling away into subdivision after subdivision, to vineyards, and to things that are of higher value.
Wow. So after all the cutting that's gone on, that vulnerability remains. I want to welcome into our conversation from Berkeley, California, Kevin O'Hara. He's a professor of silviculture at UC Berkeley. He's done a lot of research on alternatives to clear cutting. Kevin O'Hara, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You know, people focus on the 5% of old growth that remained after the 95% went away. What's your sense of how much of that is protected, safe, one way or another today?
Oh, I think it's very safe, and I think what we classify as old growth is probably going to increase over time rather than decrease. And I think that's because of what we see on some industrial ownerships, where they're not going to be cutting in stream courses, for example. And I think we're seeing an expansion of parks into cutover areas with the intent of restoring old growth features in those forests.
And what about selective cutting? Is that persuasive to you as a way to sustain, maintain redwood forest? Does that lead to new old growth forest one day, centuries hence?
Well, I think it potentially can. I basically like the idea. I'm an advocate of it. I think that if you take the people that you've spoken with today, I think we can all agree that we're all interested in sustainability. And I think we can look at sustainability as being, is including at large scales keeping ecosystems intact and functioning. I think we can talk about how sustainability means that we want to preserve the productivity of these forests. In other words, we don't want to degrade it, and I think that's happened in the past. And the third aspect, which I think is at the smallest scale, is that if we're going to cut trees out of forests, we need to provide for replacement trees. We need to provide for regeneration. And my concern over what's being advocated in the Redwood region for selective forestry is that it may not be sustainable. In other words, it may go off the other extreme.
I'm not sure which extreme you mean there, Professor.
Well, I think that what our research shows is that a redwood forest to have viable regeneration, including the sprout regeneration that you get when you cut a tree, you have to have about 40% of an open light level for those for those trees to grow.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go into a stand and you cut a third of the trees, you're probably not going to provide sufficient light for that regeneration to thrive and survive. And then if you come in another 20 years and you do the same thing, I'm concerned that it's not enough. And so what I'm talking about is more a tweaking of this single tree selection, not so much changing it completely. But I am concerned that what we're doing out there right now with these relatively light cuts may not be sustainable, in that it may provide us with larger trees that grow fast in the overstory. But are we getting the replacement trees that we need to keep this system sustainable in the long run?
In other words, will there be enough sunshine down at the base? But what, I guess the question for a layman here is, what's the goal? Is it to get back to those magnificent, towering 1,000, 1,500, 2,000-year-old trees one day? Or is it to be running through generations of 40, 50-year-old trees that keep getting turned into mulch?
Well, you've hit the point. It depends on your objective. And as Mike has said, the objective of one owner is going to be different than, say, the objective of a state park. So some people are going to be trying to produce large, magnificent trees, and other people are going to be trying to run a productive forest.
What about, Joel Byrne, when it comes to carbon sequestration has come into this as well? Redwood stands are pretty good at soaking that up, and that's a climate change issue. Does it matter if it's old growth forest or just 40, 50-year-old redwoods doing that? How does that factor in, Joel?
Well, again, you know, there are some very interesting groups out there that are looking at selling carbon credits, and because redwoods are so good at sequestering it, you know, the thought is that they could provide a new revenue stream to allow people to go from the 40-year rotations out to the 80 or the 100 or the 120-year rotations and provide them, you know, revenue to do that. And, you know, because these forests and these trees grow so so quickly and last so long, they really are the sort of Cadillac when it comes to forestry carbon sequestration. And right now, I think, of course, Dr. O'Hara could probably explain this as well. The California Air Resources Board is looking at just exactly how to do that in a way that both sort of nonprofit groups can benefit, but as well as local landowners.
The interests that continue to swirl around these magnificent trees, just incredible. Let me go to Joe in Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. I guess I was concerned about one thing. Part of what makes the trees grow is the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what makes the soil healthy is when trees naturally die, they decompose on the ground. And if you start selectively removing trees instead of letting them fall down and die and turn into soil again, what happens to the soil? What happens to the total biomass of the forest if you keep removing biomass, wood chips and things? Does the soil eventually become unsustainable?
Let us pick that up. Professor O'Hara.
Well, that's a great question, and I think what you have to think of is not so much redwoods, but any forest. If you're taking out biomass, then you're taking out nutrients, and that potentially degrades the nutrient capital of a site. But we have to think about, you know, what goes on in that forest without this sort of human activity. And redwood forests periodically experience fires that burn through the understory, and they volatilize nutrients. They consume some of that downwoody debris, and it's, you know, a lot of that's lost to the atmosphere. So it's a complex question. It depends on what ecosystem we're talking about, and I think it's safe to say that we really don't understand the full extent of it. But what we're not seeing, and if we look in places in Europe where we've been harvesting trees over and over again for centuries, we're not seeing, you know, a degradation of productivity of those sites.
Let me get a call from Brandon in Ledyard, Connecticut. Brandon, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. My question had to do with birds of prey in California, such as the California condor and the golden eagle. If they happen to nest in these trees, what kind of protection do they offer to the trees to keep them from being cut down? I know California condors aren't always nesting in trees. They focus on faces of cliffs, but they do nest in trees occasionally. And I just wanted to know if they offered these trees.
That would be federal protection that came from Endangered Species Act. Kevin O'Hara, are you clued into that? How much of the redwood stand is protected from that angle?
Well, yeah, I think a nest tree would be preserved by any owner that I can imagine out there. And so if that information is known, and probably the best example we have is the Marlboro Murrelet, which we know nests in old-growth trees. That would be more important than the golden eagle or the condor. So, yes, I would say that those trees would be maintained, and you know, as long as it's known.
Mike Fay, you're our man who's walked the length of this. It's great to have you with us from Alaska today. But when you look at these forests, what is or what should be the goal to your mind, Mike, to have sort of stands of 40, 50-year-old trees that we cut again and again, to take a lot, all of this back to old growth? What's your dream? What's your goal as a conservationist, Mike?
Well, you know, I'm also a pragmatist, and there are 6.5 billion human beings on this planet and counting, and we all use resources, and we all want to use more resources. So you have to take that into account when you're talking about conservation and preservation and ecosystem balance. So in a perfect world, I'd say, well, somehow, miraculously, humanity wouldn't have to touch nature, and we could all live productive lives, and nature could go on doing its thing. But that's not reality. The reality is California imports about 85% of its wood. California is a forested state. It can produce enough timber for its population. But if you continue to liquidate forests, and then you keep them at a low level of productivity, in my opinion, using techniques that don't allow trees to get big and better, then you're shortchanging yourself, and you're shortchanging ecosystems. And so, like Kevin says, you know, sustainability has to be kind of, in this 21st century, about sustaining ecosystem function and health rather than just, you know, producing Christmas trees. And so, in my opinion, this selection forestry and where it's going, if it gets to be perfected and we look at how much biomass we can have in the forest and how much we can take and how much ecosystem function we can have, That's where we need to go.
That's, you say, the way to go. Well, we've got a great, fast education on some magnificent trees today. Mike Fay and Joel Byrne at National Geographic, thank you so much to each of you. And Kevin O'Hara at UC Berkeley, thanks to you as well. We'll go out of our Redwood conversation with the Belfast Cowboys singing Redwood Tree. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Redwood tree.